Okay, so I'm not going to talk about information theory, so this is bad news for some of you. But good news is that I will use this term information several times in more general context. So I will be talking about some conserved relationships which are present in cerebral cortex and what you can infer from that, what you can do with those invariants and, you know, about in terms of, you know, function and architecture and all this stuff. So the outline of the talk is as follows. So first I will be talking about invariants. So basically, in the so I focus on the cortex. So basically, I will show you that brains are not that different if you chain, you know, the size of a brain. So across different mammalian species, you can find that some characteristics are conserved. So it's not like, you know, a random network. There is some order. Then I will discuss the difference between microscopic and macroscopic connectivity. By microscopic, I mean connectivity on a single neuron level, and by macroscopic connectivity, I mean connectivity between cortical areas, basically. So, and then finally, I will show you some examples where you can find trade-offs between function and architecture, and how brain development solves this problem and creates something, I mean, which is, you know, very functional. Yes. Let's start from invariants, okay. So the first invariant is surface density of neurons. So it turns out to be pretty conserved across different species, different brain sizes, and also across different cortical regions. There are some exceptions to this rule.
Excuse me, I hear this said a lot, but I don't actually think that's true.
I think it's true. I mean, according to Breitenberg and Sheets, it's true. And so if you want to argue, you should argue with them.
Yes, I do argue with them. It's, well, anyway,
yeah,
it's wrong.
Well, yeah.
What is the volume density of neurons has been measured to have a minus 1/3 power relationship, and the thickness of cortex goes up with a much shallower relationship. And the basis for the Breitenberg and Schutz statement is this measurement that I believe Raquel and
Raquel.
Powell
made.
And that was made by taking strips of cortex and counting, sort of under the assumption that neurons are point neurons. And so there's a possible problem there with the counting artifact.
Right.
Because neurons are of non-zero size.
Okay.
So I think that there is some doubt about whether the statement is true.
Okay. So. Even if this is not true, the difference would be very small because cortical thickness scales very weakly with overall brain size. So so I would say that approximately conserved. So I still stick to the Breitenberg and Sheets, you know, and this Rocker idea. So okay, second quantity would be density of synapses in gray matter. So this is okay, so I should say that n is number of neurons in the gray matter. M is average number of synapses per neuron. So basically, this is total number of synapses. If you divide this by the gray matter volume, you get something which is more or less constant. Again, across different cortical regions and across different species with different brain sizes. So this thing here is like the next density of short-range axons in gray matter, basically those axons which don't enter white matter. So L1 would be average axon length in gray matter per neuron. So this is total axon length, those local axons. If you divide this by this thing, you get, again, more or less something which is constant. And finally, I mean, not finally, but on this page, the density of long-range axons in white matter, it is supposedly constant. Although it was only checked for two species, for mouse and for cat, yeah?
When you say it's constant, it's from species to species,
Yeah, I mean, it's...
You can ask more fine questions about...
Yeah. Okay, when I say by... Yeah, there are fluctuations, yes. But, okay, they are not that big. So basically, okay, for example, this number could be, let's say, 0.8, 0.82, let's say, in some brain region. In another, it could be 0.85, yes, for example, something like that. So there are some differences, but they are small, relatively small. So for this reason, so people say something about invariances, but this is pretty conserved. Okay, and relationship between...
How well is it actually known? Well,
how well it's known? No, it's not as well known as in physics. In biology, everything is more, you know, qualitative. Sorry?
In general, I agree, but specifically these numbers. So there's probably a handful of studies.
Yeah, but so if you look to the book of Breitenberg and Sheets, you can find, you know, some numbers, really, you know, what those constants are. Yes. And especially here.
These statements, the only one that's really measured by multiple groups is the second one.
Yeah,
that one's reasonably well known. It's been, but the next one, reasonably well known, even then, what that means is people have looked at two or three species and looked at one or two locations in cortex. That's sort of what's thought of as well measured by these standards. So, like, what, you know, there's thousands of mammals, and so you'd like to look at 10 or 15, you know, 10 or 20 mammals. That would be kind of well measured. None of these are well measured like that.
Yes, so as you said, basically, it's only a few animals were studied, like mouse, rat, cat, and monkey. So based on those four animals, sometimes more, but rarely, you know, people inferred those relationships, basically. So it's not, you know, like in physics, what you do, you know, many different experiments, you know, over different, you know, setups and so on.
I think this is an interesting point because, I mean, Rodman was able to identify most of the cortical areas on the simple basis that they look structurally different. And so there must be significant differences between the structures of different areas within the one species.
Right, there's
very
some,
interesting.
Yeah, but maybe
right, there's some circuit
but
bases different. Inside
yeah,
components.
Yeah, but exactly. But differences are on the cellular level basically. It's on in terms of which genes are expressed, different genes are expressed in different areas. So yes, and on this level, it looks like, you know, more or less, those numbers are similar. Yeah. Although there are some exceptions, yes.
But I think because we have some ideas about what different areas do, it would be very interesting to see how these numbers trade off against each other. Even
it would be. Yeah. So yes, I agree. You know, it cries for more systematic, you know, investigation. Yes, that's right. Yeah, I agree.
No, sorry, I won't interrupt you.
Think of the amount of work that would be.
Is it?
So, more invariants. Okay, so this is also well-known investigated. So, the ratio of number of excitatory to inhibitory neurons, synapses, sorry, is pretty conserved. And
you know what the ratio is?
So, 85% is excitatory, and 15 would be inhibitory. Yes. So, like 5 to 1, or? Okay, and this cortical module size is probably also pretty conserved. If it changes, it changes very quickly with brain size. So these are more or less the quantities we know which are more or less conserved. Okay, so...
that ratio of 4 to 1 or 5 to 1 is also the ratio that people talk about when they talk about neurons. Excitatory versus inhibitory synapses.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That means that excitatory and inhibitory neurons make the same number of synapses?
Well, I don't know that, you know. I don't know that. But it's likely. Okay, so now, because I am a physicist, sometimes I try to do scaling. Yes. So if you rescale those parameters, like number of neurons in the cortex, number of synapses per neuron, axon length, local axon length, long range axon length, thickness of the cortex, and the average distance between neurons in the cortex, yes, with some scale S. So you must rescale other parameters in this way with some exponent alpha in order to preserve those invariants. So basically, you must do it that way. Yes. So why did I do this? I mean, I needed this for some calculation, which will be obvious later, you know, when I get back to the issue of different trade-offs. So basically, this is cartoon of a cross-section of of a brain. So this is like gray matter. Yes. Inside, it's white matter. So local axons are those which connect local neurons, basically. Those axons, they don't leave gray matter. And long-range communication is via white matter mostly. So axons enter white matter and, you know, come out here. Okay. So if you have those invariants, you can compute something which I call microscopic connectivity. So I define this. This is average quantity. Yes, I define this as a number of synapses per neuron divided by total number of neurons in the network, in the cortex. So if you use those invariants plus the fact that number of neurons in the cortex scales with gray matter volume with this exponent 0.9, which basically is a consequence of the fact that cortex is convoluted, you get that this average connectivity between neurons depends on gray matter volume of this exponent, minus 0.8. So basically, it decays with brain size. If you increase brain size, you increase volume of gray matter, and P goes down, yes, with this exponent. So as an example, so this is for a comparison between human and rat. So approximately, human has about 600 times greater volume of gray matter. So this translates to the average connectivity between neurons in this way. So human has probability of connection between neurons is 170 times less than in the rat. Yes. So this is on the microscopic level. It turns out that on a macroscopic level, there is some order. I mean, so people like Breitenberg and Schitz, they claim that on a local level, on a microscopic level, connectivity between neurons is more or less random. Yes, this is what they claim, stochastic. But people observe that on a macroscopic level, you have bigger order because you have areas, you have different modules, and those quantities also somehow connect, and they connect more orderly. So let's try to find out how connectivity between areas depends on brain size. So in order to do this, we must define several quantities. So this is, okay, cartoon of a cortical sheet. Yes. So imagine you have two areas, A and B. Yes. So each area is composed of different modules. Yes. And module size is C. I mean, linear size is C. Yes. So let's assume that the total cortical area surface is W, and area surface is W0. Yes. So now we want to find probability of connection between module, yes, that this module will terminate in some area B, yes, those axons. So this probability is composed of three different parts. So basically, Q is probability that this module actually sends axons to white matter, is Q. Probability that that this axon here will terminate in this part of the cortex, not somewhere, you know, here or here, yes, which is given by this thing. And the part which basically takes into account that there is some finite average axonal length in white matter L0. So this would be like probability of reaching this region given finite axonal length L0. Yes, this is that part. Yes. Okay?
So nothing depends on the distance between the
This is average, okay. I should say this is average connectivity, yes. So there is implicit distance here. This L0 dependence, so you take into account axonal length, yes. So if your average axonal length in white matter is bigger, this is bigger, so bigger probability of connection, yes. If it's small, you cannot reach those distance areas, yes. So there is something in, you know, like a distance in this, but not explicitly, you know. Other thing why I didn't include explicitly distance is that simply there is no data. So people only, people like Young in England, they did a lot of anatomical studies in monkey and cat, but it's mostly, you know, without, you know, distance. So basically it's they assume that it's a network, you know, there is some connectivity, but they don't quantify, you know, how connectivity depends on distance. So basically there's no data, so. You know. Yeah, yeah. So it might not. It's not true. In fact, this is why I call it average. Like if you take two random areas, basically, yes, somewhere, and you want to ask, you know, what's probability? It's not distance dependent. It's people observe that there is some dependence with distance, basically. That connectivity goes with distance, but how is not you know, precisely known. Yeah, so.
And also, it could be that some correlation with the function, you know, naively speaking.
The correlation with what?
With the function, for example, the areas you expect the areas to be more connected.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Yes, but still, you need more data for this. It's. I would say it's very scattered here. It's not easy to get, you know, high quality data, especially in terms of, you know, distance between areas and how they are connected. So it's not, if you have those data, it would be easy to do something. But, you know, because there is no data, it's you must do some, you know, average, you know, global characterization, something like that. Okay, so this was probability of connection between module in one area and some second area B. So now, what is probability that area A connects area B? So in this calculation, I assume that area A connects area B if at least one module in A connects B, at least one module. So there is at least one bundle of axons, you know, coming from A to B. So this is definition of connectivity between areas. So it's equal to this thing, basically. You must subtract of the probability that there is no connection between modules, yes? And you come out with something like that. So you see that it's 1 minus exponent of something, and this something is basically, okay, this Q probability of sending axons to white matter, yes? There is this average axonal length in white matter, L0. There is module size C, and there is number of areas K. Yes. So basically, you can use this formula for estimation of axonal length in white matter if you know connectivity between areas and if you know the number of areas K. Yes. So it can have practical application because not much is known about, you know, people. It's hard to do experiments measuring, you know, axonal length in white matter, basically. Yes. So this would be like, you know, very rough formula giving you order of magnitude. Yes. What's happening? So for example, So, and there is one caveat here, or maybe more, but at least one, which is crucial. You know, if you use different methodology to estimate number of areas, it's not obvious what methodology you use. Yes. So you must stick with the same methodology. Yes. And once you have, you know, this area count using this methodology, you must also do the connectivity between them within the same methodology. Yes. So for example, I estimated that, okay, for red, according to Young and his collaborators, there are, okay, no, this was not according to Young. This was, I found this data from some older book. So I counted, it was 26 areas, connectivity between them, non-connectivity was 0.25. So this gave me average axon length in white matter about 4.7 millimeters. So for cat and macaque, I took those data of connectivity, a number of areas from Young and his collaborators. So it gave me 12.4 millimeters. And for macaque, because this connectivity is smaller, actually, slightly, this gave me 10, so slightly less than for cat. So I did second independent evaluation using this formula I had before, using data from Almut Schietz from Germany. She gave me some data about projection experiments. So I estimated this to be in this range for macaque, so which makes more sense. Okay.
If you have an area, if areas are on the order of 1 centimeter to in size, and if you have F0 that is on the order of 1 centimeter, doesn't it mean that somewhere hidden there, only nearby areas connect? In other words, which is not.
Remember that this is average, as average. So it probably there is some distribution, yes? So it's like average, yes? So you can have axons with smaller length and axons with longer length, yes. So this is just average. Take this into account. What's the question?
Take this average only if there's a relatively sharp fall off in your distribution, which would mean that.
Well, I mean, no, not necessarily. Not necessarily. You know, I don't assume anything about distribution. I'm just saying that there is some average, yes. Defined, yes, and that's all I need. I'm not saying anything about distribution because it's not known. Yes. Okay, maybe we can talk later.
No, just one more thing.
Okay.
Let you go. But
okay.
See, if you have a distribution, I guess the average can be controlled by either small scale things or large.
Yeah,
scale.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, okay. That's right.
And here, what you're saying essentially is that the average is controlled by the smaller scales.
Well,
it's a bit surprising.
How do you know that?
I don't know what.
Yeah, but it's controlled by smaller scale.
Because I know what I mean. Because that's what the small scale that you're looking for. I mean, otherwise you would have to cook. I mean, okay. You would have to cook it up.
Okay, so the question which I asked was basically how this quantity with this connectivity, average connectivity between areas, depends on brain size. So to answer this question, you must know how those parameters here depend on brain size, yes, how they change with brain size. Yes. So, okay. So number of areas, this is according to Mark Changizi, scales with brain size with exponent around 0.4. So we don't know how, as I said, axonal length in white matter scales with brain size. So people like Zhang and Sejnovsky assumed that probably average axonal length in white matter should scale with diameter of the whole brain. So this would give us here exponent 1/3. Yes. If you say that that this axon length should be proportional not to the diameter of the whole brain but only to the white matter volume, yes. So like for example, Mark suggested, So you get this beta in this range around 0.4. So I computed this based on this estimation from the previous page, that this beta is around 0.26. So probably the true value of this exponent beta probably is in this range 0.26, 0.4, in this range probably, yes? So what about patches? So the module size should be proportional to the patches width in the cortex. And I collected some data, basically. I have it here. It's a graph. So basically, this is patches width of in V1 area, each of those species. And you can see that there is no systematic dependence of this width on brain size, basically. For the, you know, it's a random scatter, basically, yes. So I assume that this thing's patches width, and for this reason, module size basically doesn't depend on brain size.
So how did you define a patch?
Well, the way they define in experimental papers, basically. So, you know, they somehow can measure those different dots, black dots, yes, and they can measure the width. Yes.
So these are orientation columns?
Not necessarily. Well, they don't say precisely what it is, but...
Well, when you inject a cell...
Yeah, they inject something... That's right, yeah, yeah. So it could be columns, dominance, I mean, ocular dominance or whatever, yeah, so...
The size of a patch in V1 might be quite sensitive to the visual ecology.
Actual visual ecology.
Exactly, and this will confound it. So
there's a larger...
You need a much larger sample.
There is a larger sample. There's an article...
That's right, but this was the only thing I could find.
There's an article that Leah Krubitzer has written in which they, she and co-authors have a list of about, I forget, like 30 different columns and modules from different parts of the cortex. And they define it in some cases, you know, the V1, you have clear landmarks because it's a highly periodic structure. In other cases, they use immunological markers or other kind of periodicities that they can see. So they, and they have data from shrew up to whale. And Mark, didn't you plot these data?
Yeah, they actually report, they don't plot anything there because they report that it's constant, that the distance on the surface of the cortex is a constant as a function of brain size. But in fact, if you actually plot it, it increases as roughly the 1/9th-ish power of brain size, which is exactly...
Yes, it's very shallow.
Which is exactly what you'd expect if the number of neurons actually across the linear dimensions, the number of neurons along the linear dimension of the surface is actually constant because of the neural neural density decrease. So.
Well, it's funny, because if the modules get larger, diameter gets larger as 1/9, and the thickness goes a little one. That means the volume of these things goes up as the cube root of brain size.
But
and
this
I've
is more
before that neuron density goes down as the cube root. So that suggests that an invariant that you haven't mentioned is that the number of neurons in a module is conserved. And developmentally, that makes a lot of sense because you can kind of imagine, you can start imagining a developmental mechanism that conserves that. So this is just five.
Yeah, so basically, if there is any dependence, it's extremely weak, yes, the exponent around 0.1, yes. So, so I assume that more or less it's constant, yes, for this reason that I don't see any big dependence. Okay, so this is again what I said before, that I found, based on those estimations, that average axon length in white matter scales with brain size, basically gray matter volume, this exponent 0.26, yes? So if you have more species, probably they would be somewhere here, supposedly. Okay. So coming back to our question, how this connectivity between cortical areas scales with brain size. Yes. So if you put those scaling laws for those parameters, you get something like that. A is constant, more or less, across different brains. And you get here dependence on gray matter volume with exponent delta, which is the previous exponent by this relationship. And so if you put here those different values of beta and Markov value 0.4 for the scaling of a number of areas with brain size, you get that that using my beta 0.26, you get delta here around minus 0.28. And for value beta, which is this, assuming that axon length in white matter scales with diameter of white matter, you get delta zero. So basically, so the conclusion from this is that the connectivity between areas either depends very weakly on the brain size, this exponent minus point, or doesn't depend, yes. So probably again, the true value of exponent delta here is somewhere in this range between 0 and minus 28, yes, which again, if you put numbers here, for example, for I put numbers here for mouse and human, so there is a difference of four orders of magnitude between humans and mouse, yes. But if you put here this difference, you get that connectivity between areas in mouse and humans is only differs by a factor of 3.8 basically, so not that much. For mouse, you get 0.30, and for human, you get around 0.08, yes. Okay. So the message from this is that probably the connectivity between areas depends weakly on brain size, not as quickly as connectivity between neurons, yes, on a neural level, on a single neural level. Okay, so what you can do with this information, yes. So now I will change a little subject, and I will talk about different trade-offs in a cortical architecture, and I will show you that that you can find some examples on a local level and also on a microscopic level with and there are some constraints, and those constraints are very conflicting in outcome. So there is some competition between constraints. Okay, let me give you first example on a local network level. So to start with this, so first let me remind you about these ideas, old ideas of Kaya from the turn of the century. So basically, this guy claimed that the brain uses resources in such a way as to well, makes everything functional, yet not to overuse resources, basically, yes. And people thought that axons and dendrites, basically, because they are important in communication between neurons, yes, that axons are very important, yes, and that the total axon length should be as small as possible, yes. So some people claim that this is necessary for to minimize delays between neurons, and some people claim that this is also necessary because biochemical maintenance of axons is costly, yes, because all those different proteins which are present in axons and so on. Okay, so those guys plus Mitya, recent years, Mitya Skowski was one of those advocates of this principle, strong advocates. Okay. So, but there is a problem with this minimal axon length principle, basically, that it doesn't take into account energetic cost of information transfer, you know, between neurons. So basically, if you have two neurons, A and B, let's say, yes, so somehow they communicate via other neurons, yes, in the network, yes, and because such communication requires spike, yes, so synapses here must be active, yes, and because we know that, as Simon said many times, that, you know, each spike requires energy, and also some people are claiming that synapses, also activity of synapses, requires a lot of energy. So for this reason, each this step requires energy. As the more steps you need to connect two neurons to transfer information, the more energy basically you need. Yes. So, okay. So I associate the metabolic cost of, let's say, information transfer between those neurons A and B with minimal degree of separation between those two neurons. So basically, by this I mean the number of steps you need to take to connect those two neurons. Yeah. So this is very, you know, very simple idea, maybe too simple, but...
there's also cost of time.
Yeah, but let's focus on energy, I mean, first. So basically, you can think about axon length as a biochemical cost, or like a delay in the network, and the degree of separation as an energetic cost in information transfer. Yes, let's think in this term. So optimal wiring should take into account both those principles. So, you know, essentially, we'd like to minimize both of those things. Yes, to have as small as possible axons and as small as possible, you know, the number of steps you need to want to connect two neurons, basically in the network. Yes, but this turns out to be impossible to satisfy, and I will show you why this is. I mean, this is conflicting. Okay, so imagine this is again very simple figure here. So imagine you have two neurons A and B. Yes, so if you have longer axons, you need only a few steps to connect A and B, basically, in the network, essentially, yes? But if your axon length is small, you need more steps to connect two neurons. So if you have more steps, you need more energy, because all these steps require spikes, yes, and synapses here. So basically, there is a conflict, yes, between basically saving axons and saving energy in communication. Yes, very simple idea. Yes.
Excuse me, I don't see how the green line is shorter than the blue line. To me, it looks like your length is comparable.
Okay, this is only very schematic figure. I mean, you can compute this basically using those invariants which I had in the beginning. Yes, you can compute exactly how axon length scales with basically brain size, and how this degree of separation between neurons scales. Yes, and you can see. I will have it in a minute if you wait.
Let me ask one question.
Yeah. Okay.
Are you trying to minimize the average axon length, or the
this is
total length of the axons in the brain?
No. This would be axon length per neuron. So this thing here.
So.
Yeah.
It will be more favorable to cover that distance, the same total distance in axon length, but using three smaller axons? Will that be metabolically more favorable?
No, it's something in between. Something in between, you know. Just, you know, let me finish and the next
There typically there are many parallel paths.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, I'm going to talk this in a second. You know, if you allow me. So basically, I'm saying here that okay, it's very simple. If you have longer axons per neuron, you need less steps. Basically, you know, you could think that you need less steps to connect two neurons. So for this reason, less energy, but you know, you have more axons. But if your axon length is small per neuron is smaller, you need more steps. Okay. Okay, because you wanted this computation. Okay, to be more mathematical here, although some people don't like it at this point, you can define something like probability. Okay, so now you have two neurons, those blue dots, yes? You have different paths between them, yes? You can connect them at different, you know, different level. So if you define probability SKR, probability of K-step connection between neurons separated by some distance, in at least one path, yes? You can have many of them, yes? If you define this, so you can compute this actually thing. It depends on, you know, this very ugly expression, and P is probability of connection between two neurons, basically. Yes, between those guys and those guys. Yes. So you have this ugly expression, yes. But you can simplify this if you do this scaling, if you increase the network size to infinity, basically. This expression simplifies. I have here this formula. But it is either one or zero if you go with your network size. If you take very big.
It depends on the shape of the P. It depends on the product of the P.
Well, it depends.
That would be true for a very.
But as I said, if you use those invariants, you can say something about this shape. Yes, not much, but you can. In such a way that it becomes almost universal dependent.
So alpha is related to that product, I imagine, right?
Alpha is, well, yeah, it's, yeah.
So what is the product from the invariant to the exponent?
Which exponent?
So the P falls off, right?
Yeah.
And I guess if you're deducing that product from your invariant, it can only fall off as a parallel, right?
Yeah.
So you know what that exponent is?
This exponent is alpha exponent, basically. Yes.
Yeah, but numerically?
Numerically, it's 0.1.
Okay, so then.
Okay.
So if it's that shallow, falloff, I agree, but then it's strange that the average would be controlled by the short distance, which was my initial.
This is local network. Okay, yeah. This is not local network. This is not global. So it's like, as I said, this is local connectivity, yes, basically, within colonel, you know. Local size. Okay, so if you do this, you get, this is strict calculation, and you get that, you know, that if you plot this average connectivity, average number of steps needed, you get something like that. You don't see from this, but okay, so this is this exponent alpha, which I had in the beginning, very beginning. So this is how this axon length per neuron scales of exponent alpha, it grows exponentially, basically, if you use those invariants. And this degree of separation, meaning, you know, cost of energy in communication, decreases with exponent alpha. There are some here plateaus, but, you know, basically the trend is decaying. So the optimal situation is somewhere in between, yes, where you have both not too large axon length and, you know, not too large energetic cost, basically, not too big a degree of separation, yes. So in the brain, actually, alpha is 0.1, so it's somewhere here, yes. So it looks like in the brain, it's more advantageous to save axons than actually this energy in communication, basically, which is required. So because it's somewhere here, it's not 0.9, it's 0.1, so axons are more important probably in the brain as to save axons than to. Okay, so this is the first example, not too sophisticated, but you know, it's some hint that there are some conflicting constraints, you know, which govern the brain design. So now this would be more controversial, but you know. So, probably many of you agree that one of the main functions of the brain is to process different forms of information. Yes, and so basically, if you think about that, what should brain try to do to optimize efficiency of computation? Yes, so you can identify, let's say, I could identify three basically principles. You can find more of them basically, yes, on a cellular level, on a molecular level, but on a global level, if you neglect all complications in the brain, you can find three principles, which, you know, if you scale your brain up, which should, you know, you can think should be, you know, optimal things to try to conserve. So the number of areas should increase as quickly as possible with the brain size. So this is what was advocated by John Kass, basically. He was saying that if animal has more cortical areas, then it can process various forms of information locally, basically, yes, and somehow integrate it. So the more areas, the more tasks the animal can do, basically. This is what John Kass was saying. The second principle is that the connectivity between areas should more or less not depend on brain size. So basically, for bigger brains, you would like your areas to maintain constant connectivity, because otherwise, if this connectivity would decay with brain size, then areas would be isolated, yes, if you scale your brain up, yes, and then the communication between areas would be less efficient, yes. So this would be the second principle, yes. And the third principle is about delays between cortical areas. So if you scale up your brain again, you would like that those delays do not increase with brain size. So this ideally, naively, would expect this would be good for the brain to maintain constant delay, yes. So this delay should be proportional to the ratio of average axon length in white matter divided by volume, by velocity of propagation of signal. Because it's white matter, this velocity is proportional to the axon diameter in white matter. Yes. So if you use those three principles, yes, as I said, I mean, you can find more of them, but let's focus on those three just. Yeah. This Q which I computed, yes, this Q, so at least I would naively think that it should be constant, brain size independent, yes.
Okay. I don't understand the terms here. So when you say connectedness, does it mean the number of possible connections, number of connections into
connectivity, like a fraction of connections, yes, like
but
percentage.
It's impossible because number of possible connections increases exponentially. You can't make it independent
of size. No, probability of connection, connectivity. What probability that A and B are connected? It must be always less than one, yes? It cannot increase exponentially because you would.
Total number of possible connections increase exponentially. Not
total. I'm talking about probability of connection between A and B. So it's not like the total number of connections, but connectivity.
Into a given area.
Two random areas, let's say. Yeah, okay. Average connectivity, yes.
Talking about direct connectivity.
Sorry?
Directly connected or indirectly?
Directly connected. Directly.
This last statement here, you're going to do something assuming that axon diameter scales up with L0. Linearly, is that what you're
going to
do there?
That axon diameter scales with L0? No.
I mean,
no, I'm not.
What are you doing with this data?
No, okay, I'm saying
you don't
here,
have data on axon diameter.
Okay, I'm saying here that.
That should be constant.
That you would naively expect that the tau delay between areas, yes, should be constant. I'm not saying anything about how L0 scales with D or brain size at this point. So just this is equal to this, proportional, yes? So the distance divided by...
I understand all that stuff. I'm just trying to figure out what it is you're trying to say.
Just wait a second. You will see on the next slide. Okay, now, so I have this hypothesis about those three principles, yes? Now, if you assume that white matter volume is proportional to the volume of axons in white matter, you get this relationship, basically. This should be proportional, yes? So n is the number of neurons, in the gray matter. L0 again is axonal length in white matter, and d is diameter of those white matter axon. Yes. So now, if you put instead of those three things, those parameters characterizing those three principles, like number of areas, okay, connectivity between areas Q, delay between areas tau, yes, you get basically that the ratio of the volume of white matter to gray matter ratio is proportional to this thing. Okay? So as I said, K, Q, and tau are related to those principles I had on the previous transparency. Yes? So now, okay. So if we require now, as I said before, that the number of areas should grow as quickly as possible with brain size, yes? So this would very quickly grow with brain size. I said that Q, you know, for functional reasons, should be brain size independent, yes? So it doesn't depend on brain size. Tau also, again, you know, according to that principle I had before, we would naively expect that it doesn't depend on brain size, yes? So those doesn't depend on brain size. Only K depends on brain size, and this, you know, it's weak dependence here, so let's neglect this for a second. So, okay, if this is the case that the whole thing quickly grows with brain size, then this ratio would also go quickly with brain size, yes? So at some scale, the volume of white matter, so basically the volume of wire, would be greater than the volume of unit processing information, yes? So it's undesirable, it should be undesirable for the brain, yes? So somehow development makes this trick that allows K to grow, I mean, not that quickly with brain size, yes, slower increase with brain size, to allow Q connectivity between areas decrease slightly with brain size, as those calculations suggested that probably, you know, Q decays weakly with brain size, yes, and also to allow tau to increase with brain size, as is the case, really, yes. So in this case, you reducing the excessive scaling of this side with brain size. For this reason, this thing, this ratio doesn't increase with brain size too much, yes? And this turns out to be what is happening basically in the brain. I mean, if you compare, yes, this is what I said before, it's written now here. So in order to reduce this excessive scaling of white matter with gray matter, what you have to do, as I said, to allow K, number of areas, to grow with brain size with smaller exponent, like 0.4, like Mark was saying. Also, to increase the delay with brain size, yes, and decrease Q with brain size, which basically what comes from my calculations is. So, as I said, if you compare what's happening really in the brain is that delay actually, using my exponent how L0 depends on brain size, and D depends very, very weakly on brain size. If you put those scaling laws here, you get that the average delay between areas increases with brain size with exponent point around 0.2. And you know, this is my result from previous calculations that Q, yes, okay, is somewhere in the range between minus, this exponent is between 0 and minus 0.28. Yes. So again, it decreases quickly with brain size. So okay, what follows from this? So somehow, so we have those conflicting outcomes, yes? You would like to have as many areas as possible, but it turns out that it would be stupid to do this because then you would have to have white matter, you know, very, very huge, yes? So the brain would have to be, you know, a very huge thing. Yes, you want to reduce this thing, yes? You want to have brain as small as possible yet to do computation. So somehow you must compromise some of, you know, other principles like increased delay with brain size, which happening, and decrease connectivity between areas with some small exponent, yes? This is what you're trying to do, and what seems to happen in the brain. Okay, I am close to finish. One more thing. This is somehow, you know, loosely related to the main theme. So it's like estimation of how many synapses are active simultaneously at resting condition in the cerebral cortex. This is a rough estimate. So I would like to show you that basically, if you scale your brain up, the fraction of active synapses decays basically the brain size. So okay. So if we agree that that the total energy consumption in the cortex is related to the number of active synapses in the brain, so F is fraction of active synapses, N times M is the total number of synapses in the brain, in the gray matter, then because this scales with VG, you get something like that. On the other hand, using old result of scaling law based on experimental data of Hoffman from 83, you get that this was a basal metabolic rate, oxygen consumption, basically. So this is how he did that. So you can find that it depends on gray matter volume and body volume of this exponent. But if you relate gray matter volume to body with some exponent, which is well known, you get dependence of energy consumption on gray matter volume exponent 0.8. So comparing those two things, you get that the fraction of active synapses at resting condition scales with brain size with this exponent. So it decays very weakly decreases with brain size, essentially. So this indicates, this says that, but as Simon is saying again, that energy is not cheap. Brains try not to overuse energy because, you know, it's costly. So for this reason, if you scale your brain up, you know, relatively less synapses are active, you know, at resting conditions. So it's consistent with this idea. Okay. Not so. To summarize the whole thing, you know, it's probably you are tired now. So this is like a summary, maybe obvious for many, but so what I wanted to say here is that brain development is not a trivial thing. That somehow brain development had to devise, you know, this the brain in such a way, despite those conflicting, you know, things, and to form, you know, something which actually works, which basically works. And so the architecture is in some sense optimal, and what is optimal is of course under debate, but, you know, I think most of you agree that, you know, the brain, I mean, design tries to optimize something, yes, and those were examples what it might try to optimize. Of course, you know, there's no proof for this, but, you know, it's indication that, you know, actually development is trying to, you know, somehow reconcile different conflicting outcomes, I mean, constraints which are present during development and later. Okay, thanks.
Fraction of synapses in larger brains.
You mean
active synapses?
I mean, what do you mean by that?
I don't know. Is there any data on this number?
Okay, it's like indirect estimate. Yes, what is known is this oxygen consumption of the whole cortex. Yes, it scales that way with brain size. Yes. So on the other hand, you can assume that that this energy consumption comes mostly from synapses, because they are the most costly. Yes. So which probably is true in bigger brains. You know. So Simon's estimate was for mouse. Yes. So its action potentials are slightly more costly than synapses.
So
but
mice, rat, monkey, human.
Yeah. So if you go up, synapses becoming more costly, basically. Yes. So if you assume that synapses, you know, consume the most energy, then say did here is what you can do is you can you can assume that you have this relationship basically. So the energy is like a fraction of, you know, the number of active synapses, which is basically this. This is fractions to the number of synapses. You get this simple relationship, which comes from those invariants in the beginning I had, because this scales with volume of gray matter, yes, in this way. So if you compare those two things, you get this simple formula, basically. This is what all you can do.
That's a prediction,
but,
essentially.
Yeah, it's prediction, but, well, I'm not sure whether, you know, it's probably not easy to check this. I don't think you can easily check this.
I mean, I think it's definitely true that because essentially, basically, because of Kleiber's law, which says that specific metabolic rate decreases with increasing body size, that the specific metabolic rate of gray matter has to also decrease with body size and therefore with brain size.
Yeah.
And there's only two ways, well, three ways, in fact, that the system can deal with this. One is to increase the size of neurons. That decreases the specific metabolic rate by decreasing the energy density.
Yeah.
The second is to reduce the mean firing rate, which reduces both synapses and spike costs.
Yeah.
And the third is to reduce the release probability, which synapses, or reduce the number of active synapses, which then reduces the synaptic cost.
Yeah.
And that all essentially boils down. Well, the second two, reducing spikes and reducing synaptic release probability, essentially reduces down to reducing signal density.
Yeah.
Once you do that, you begin to wonder, well, maybe the way the brain has to respond to this is to direct its signals between areas in a more logical, efficient way.
Yeah.
And that means your assumption of uniform connectivity between areas now has to be challenged to accommodate these metabolic constraints.
Well, I mean, it wasn't assumption of uniformity in the connectivity. It was basically, well, like a rough estimate of average connectivity. So
yes, it is. But I mean, it's the same with our energy budget. We assume that all cortical areas and neurons are the same.
Yeah.
It's obviously nonsense.
Of course. Yeah.
You see something when you first do it.
Yeah, but
once
still,
you've done it, you've seen it, you move on and you
but
say, well,
still,
I have to question this assumption.
To be motivated to do something more challenging, more exciting, you need more data, which is not there. So I see a lot of, you know, drawbacks here. I mean, it's basically, I would call it dead end, because, you know, there's not much data you can support this. These are just, you know, simple ideas from, you know, coming from, you know, simple scaling laws plus some, you know, physics calculation, but that's all you can do. I mean, you cannot, at least now, you cannot.
I thought there was a lot of data about projections between visual areas, for example.
But yeah, visual areas, yes. But
and there's, you know, intratemporal and parietal streams suggesting that, you know, there's a big divergence of visual information.
When I was doing this thing a few years ago, I was more interested in like a global, you know, which was maybe error, but of course, looking into specific part of the core, like visual areas, which are well investigated, would be more beneficial. Yeah.
One question: Is there anything known about the dependence of the firing rate on the body?
Firing rate
of
what?
Firing rate of what? Brain volume.
Should be easy to measure.
Anecdotally, there are signatures of different types of firing in the brain that seem to be about the same. Like, you know, when people talk about theta rhythm, for instance, I think it's about the same in different sized brains. Or, you know, some of these faster, like, I forget what they're called. Like, what's not 40 hertz, that's gamma.
Gamma oscillations.
So, this doesn't really answer it, but, you know, people who do in vivo physiology don't really report huge differences in rates among species. It doesn't rule out a shallow dependence, but just, you know, when you talk to people who stick electrodes into brains all the time, they don't talk about this.
But I think actually, I mean, that there are many important variables that haven't been determined for these sorts of arguments, and actually mean firing rate is one of them.
Yeah.
And the two problems are, first of all, there was a sort of a fashion grew up in the literature about 15 years ago to express all firing rates as percentage of background, but not report what the background was. And the second thing is that if you're doing intracellular recordings, you bias your extracellular recordings, you bias your samples towards cells that are more active. And in a few studies where people have got over this bias by recording in one area and stimulating in another one so they can actually see their electrode is still attached to this axon and is recording it, they record very, very low.
Another way to get rid of the bias is to use patch clamp recording, some kind of recording where you have a different physical criterion for whether you have a neuron. Like, so in patch clamp recording, you push against the neuron, you form a physical seal, and then you break in and you see, you ask the question whether it's firing. It turns out when you do that, the number of lurkers in the brain is just vast. All right, so like the old report in, for instance, in cerebellum is that, oh, granule cells fire at 40 hertz. But it turns out when you stick electrodes in, they're actually attached to neurons. What granule cells mostly do is nothing. So there's there are these huge measurement biases that make it very hard to answer some of these questions.
But for people who build grand theories of the brain, the mean firing rate is actually an incredibly important parameter. And it's really just not known, I think. We took a guess at it.
How did you guess?
I went and I read, to be quite honest, I was shocked because I went away and I read the literature and looked at data from awake behaving rats and came up with this answer of 4 hertz. And then we plugged it into the calculations. It predicted the specific metabolic rate very well. So we really did do it that way around, not the other, but I'm sure it's a happy accident. I mean, this is the thing about global theories. That
that's right. Yeah.
There's a lot of insight.
Yeah.
And then eventually you get to the limit where you start.
That's right. Okay, it's like you see that, you know, you cannot go any further with this. Yes, I agree. Yes, I agree.
I'm not saying that taking global theory is worthless. I think it's actually very.
Well, I mean, it was, you know, initially it was, somewhat insightful for me, you know, to see those relationships. But, you know, now, you know, if you know them, you know, the question is so what you can do with this further, and I don't see much you can do with this, you know, in the future. So that's the problem,
there are many variables here which are in principle measurable, so I don't
know. Well, but it's still locally, and it's like if you want to
check something.
But, you know, again, not many animals are investigated, basically. It's like standard to look at rat and cat.
Well, that's enough. I mean, three other families of all.
Depending on the question, yes. So this was more ambitious question here. Yes, but, so if you are modest and try to answer, you know, smaller questions, yes, of course. You can look in the literature, you know, for 1 year, 2 years, and, you know, maybe you find something. But I'm not sure I'm going to do this.
No, not you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for listening.